Good evening, and greetings to each one of you this evening. It's good to be here. This is actually my first time to be at Shirksville, and really enjoy learning to know a few of you here in the front bench. And if they are any indication of what the rest of the congregation's like, I think we're in good company tonight. So glad to be here and worship with you. In relation to Eric's comment about Steve being blessed, I think it would be on the part of modesty to acknowledge that if Steve has been blessed when he heard me speak, it's the Spirit of God. It's not necessarily anything that I have to share. And I certainly don't feel that way tonight. When Eric asked me to speak on this bridging the generation gap, I guess I was initially intrigued with the title. And I thought that, I like that. But it didn't go very long until I realized that it wasn't because I had anything to say on it. It's because I wish I could hear some advice on the subject. And so Eric doesn't know how many times I wished I could back out of it, but we're here tonight. And I think with the Word of God in front of us, we can't go wrong. There's two groups of people here that I'd like to acknowledge before we get started. The one is you as a congregation. I see quite a few crowns of glory scattered back through the group, hoary heads. And I'd love to hear what you have to say on this bridging the generation gap. For myself, I do not feel like the wind is to my back on this. It's something I'm in right now. Something we're facing, and I can't stand here with a list of successes. And so I want to acknowledge you as a congregation, you as a group. And I'd love to hear what you have to say afterward on it. Your comments, your critique, bring it on, I'd love to hear it. And I'd also like to acknowledge my family. They, more than anyone else, will know if the preacher is practicing what he's preaching tonight, and they'll know more than anyone else if I put to practice what I'm saying, or if they're left to wonder, I wonder where he got that. And so thank you to my family for all your graciousness and love, and I think if we work at this together, the hope of God, we can make it through. Bridging the generation gap. How many of you know what a bridge is? How many of you could say how many bridges you crossed to get here tonight? I thought of, before we left, I thought maybe I should count on the way here how many bridges I cross or go under, but I'm sure I would have lost track. And we know what a bridge is. It's a structure for crossing an obstacle. It's a means of connection. Now, how many of you know what a ford is? I'm not talking about these machines with the little blue oval on either. How many of you know what a ford is? Okay, some of you do. About 4 miles, or not even four miles, maybe 2 miles from my place, there's a little back country road, kind of a deserted township road. And you want to go about a mile and a half till you come to a creek, and there's no bridge. The only way to get to the other side is to drive through the creek. Those fords are kind of long forgotten by this modern world, but they used to be the only way to get across a stream or a river. Centuries ago, as settlers moved across the American frontier, they faced many obstacles. There was canyons, there was ravines, there was rivers, there were streams. And these posed real-life problems for the early settlers. You can imagine that they spent hours coming to a river. Now, how are we going to get across? Probably parked the horse and walked a mile downstream and upstream. Where's the best crossing? They were real-life problems, and they spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to cross the river, how to navigate this ravine. These old world problems, today we speed across them in the blink of an eye. All because someone was willing to build a bridge. I'd like you to think of that a little bit in relation to generations. That means of connection. We have a generation here and we have a generation here, and how are we going to get across the divide? It's a problem, but if there's a bridge there, we can connect the two. I'm a little bit surprised that Steve can preach here without a whiteboard, and I was expected to use one tonight, but we'll make do without. How many of you are familiar with Lake Tobias? Okay, you all are familiar with Lake Tobias. So where I live, I'm west of Lake Tobias across the Susquehanna River, and I'm actually kind of between the Juniata River and the Susquehanna River. So the Juniata River kind of comes down from the northwest, Susquehanna comes down from the northeast, and they meet at Clark's Ferry, come to a point. And I'm kind of like right between the two rivers, almost more to the Susquehanna River. But anyway, if you would leave my place and go to Lake Tobias, that area across the east of the Susquehanna, it's only about 15 minutes at the most. Or 13 miles, 15 minutes if you could drive straight there. But there's no bridge across the Susquehanna. I either have to come the whole way down to Clark's Ferry and back up, or else go the whole way up to Sealand's Grove and back down. And to drive that, it takes about 45 minutes, and it's more like 30 miles. And I remember going there as a boy, and to me, we went to a faraway place when we went to Lake Tobias. But I got older and realized that, well, if I go a few miles from my home, I can actually look across the river almost to where it is. But there's no bridge there. And it's that way to this day. And we can look across the river, we can see activity over there, but the ones on the west side of the river and we on the west and they on the east live very different lives. We can be within sight of each other, but without the bridge, their home turf is over there and we're over here. It illustrates the concept of bridges and what bridges can do. I'd like you to go to Psalm 145. We're going to start there tonight. Picking up the thought of generations, I'd like to just look here a little bit more at the thought of bridging and generations, and then I'd like to consider a little bit what gaps are, what gaps we're thinking about. And then I have 6 points using an acrostic for the word bridge. So here in Psalm 145, verse 3 and 4, I'm going to read. Psalmist writes, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise thy works to another and shall declare thy mighty acts." This thing of generations was God's idea. When he created Adam and Eve and all the animals, he said, "Be fruitful and multiply," and he put into motion a process of generation. I believe it was in God's wisdom that he created the generations. Here in verse 3, it says, "His greatness is unsearchable." And I think this greatness, and maybe even his unsearchable greatness, is bound up in this thing of the revolving generations. You know, God could have created us like the mayflies or like the cicadas, where we live and they lay their eggs for the next generation, and then they go and die, and later the next generation comes on, and there's no connection. God could have made it that way, and he would have been perfect in doing it if he would. But he saw, I believe in his wisdom, the need for generations to overlap and connect. And he's laying this burden on us. He says in verse 4, "One generation is to declare and is to speak." It's commanded by God. So what are the gaps that we're thinking of here tonight? If we're talking about bridging a gap, I thought maybe it'd be good if we could wrap our minds a little bit around what the gap is. And I just have two considerations on this thought of gap. And the first one is just time itself. So when a young child, a baby is born, little girl, little boy, they grow to adulthood and have children of their own. It's often between 20 and 30 years. And so we figure a generation to be 20 to 30 years. And so this time alone is what, two and a half decades? It's a fair bit of time passes between one generation to the next. And in that time, you have a whole different set of circumstances. You have changes in society. You have technology advancements. And all these things bring a whole different world to another generation. A change in generations can often become inflection points. And what I mean by that is that the curvature or the trend of the previous generation suddenly gives way to a new direction. And that's due to a variety of factors. And that makes it very difficult sometimes for generations to overlap. And I'll just explain a little bit, maybe by explaining some generation terms. About 50 years ago, sociologists looked at habits and ways of different generations, and they kind of categorized the generations, at least of the 20th century. I'm not sure if it goes back beyond that or not, but from 1901 to 1927 was termed the greatest generation. These were children that were born during World War I. They lived through the Spanish flu. They experienced the Roaring Twenties. They lived through the Great Depression. They fought in World War II. And after the two world wars, they went on to live very successful lives in business and politics. And all those factors combined that they experienced to live through, they were termed the greatest generation. Following them, those born in 1928 to 1945 were called the silent generation. These were children that were young through the World War and the Great Depression, and thus they were very acquainted with rationing and frugality. And some of us have parents, grandparents, that was very much a part of their mindset. This generation was quite patriotic, and they understood that you don't speak out against authority, having come through the world wars. And so they were known to keep their head down, and they had a very strong work ethic. Those born in 1946 through 1965 were called the baby boomers. This generation was the largest generation. It was born following World War II. A lot of them were veteran babies. And they saw fast progress post-World Wars. And thus they tended to be very cautious and conservative. From 1965 to 1980, you had Gen X. These were born into a world of new developments, and particularly the television. And thus this generation is known not so much for what they did, but for what they watched. 1981 to 1996, we have the millennials. The technology really defines this generation, growing alongside technological advances the whole way from the phone on the wall to the smartphone in your pocket. And the effects of this is seen in this generation leaning highly liberal. 1997 to 2010, you have Gen Z. These folks are digital natives. They know the digital world like the back of their hand. Thus, they are highly engaged in social issues and politics. And then from 2011 to the present, you have Generation Alpha, or Gen Alpha. And this generation does not know a world without a smartphone. It belongs in their hand. They are highly engaged in activism. And you can see that taking place in the world around us. So I'd like you to observe a couple things. With each generation and the new generation coming on, you have the greatest generation. You can see how the Great Depression and World War II shaped the resilience and values of the silent generation. You can see how the digital technology forced many baby boomers and Gen X to adapt how they interacted with millennials and Gen Z. And it's interesting, the baby boomers, they say, are known to be conservative. And then they were followed by Gen X, which they say is known for not what they did, but what they watched, the explosion of the television. And then you have the millennials following, and they're highly liberal. And so in three generations, you have a society going from leaning conservative to leaning liberal. There's many other things that work. One of the more recent inflection points, I think, that we've been through is the COVID-19 pandemic. And one way that this has really changed society is that it forced a rapid, massive shift to remote work and digital interaction. And so we have everything from communication to commerce, information access, and even our identity can quickly and permanently be altered, forcing any given generation to adapt and figure out how to bridge the gap between the two. So that was just the time and all the forces at play in a generation of time is one of the gaps, I think, is part of the gap. The other part of the gap I'd like you to think about is, let's go to Psalm 78. I'd like to read a few verses here in Psalm. Psalm 78, I think another part of this gap is not only the time and the changes that time brings, but it's the soul's inclination away from God. I'm going to read here in Psalm 78, verse 1 through verse 8. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. And might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, whose spirit was not steadfast with God. And he's referring back to, I'm going to stop reading there, he's referring to Israel and their tendency to backslide away from God, to forget God. And he says here in verse 7, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God. Well, why would they forget the works of God? It's true that time has a way of eroding that. We can, you know, with time, we tend to forget. So yes, time may have influenced them to forget, but I think it was more than that. There is a bent within our own heart collaborating with the old serpent to take us away from God. And we talk about young people coming to the age of accountability. And I think what we really mean is a generation needing to reckon with a divide or a gap. So on one hand, they have their parental generation, which have found and followed God. And over here is the world. And which are they going to choose? And as Christian parents, I believe this is part of the gap that we hope to bridge by the grace of God. Now for the six main points of the message here. I'd like to use the acrostic bridge and just think of a few things that maybe can help us to bridge the gap. For B, I have Bible-based life. And there would be more. You could say, well, maybe we should say born-again believer. Maybe we should use that one. But I prefer the first because it's not just Christians that are successfully bridging gaps. There are Muslims that are doing it. There are atheists that are doing it. There's many Muslims that are successfully getting their succeeding generations to put their effort into jihadists and terrorism. So I don't think we can say that it's only a born-again believer that can successfully bridge the gap. However, I would contend that whether it's Muslim, whether he thinks it's his religious zeal that makes it happen, or whether it's the atheist, and he would say it's common sense, I would say no matter where it happens, any good that is accomplished could be traced back to God or to truth. Whether they acknowledge it or not, it still comes from the Bible and from the truth of God's word. And so that's why I would tend to prefer the Bible-based life. And we're doing ourselves an injustice to think that we can somehow have the ideals for our children, for the next generation, and yet we can somehow kind of slip under the radar and we don't have to quite to live up to the standard of truth that we expect out of them. Please turn with me back to Proverbs chapter 2. If you're going to have your life based in the word, based on truth, you're going to have to go to God for some wisdom. Here in Proverbs chapter 2, verse 6. For the Lord giveth wisdom, and out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. Turn over to chapter 9, verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. And we're not talking about being scared of God tonight. When he says the fear of the Lord, we're not trying to run away from God because we're scared of him. You children understand that, I think, that you fear your parents. There's a certain fear of your parents, but you're not scared of them. It's a reverential fear, something that you want to please them because their word stands and there's accountability if you don't follow through. Turn to Psalm 111, verse 10. There's another verse here I'd like to pick up on. Psalm 111, verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and I like this, a good understanding have all they that do his commandments. His praise endureth forever. I like that thought of a good understanding have all they that do his commandments. There's something that comes with obedience, whether it's to God, to parents. God's promising that there's going to be an understanding that follows that. And I really don't know tonight what takes more wisdom than relating prudently to the rising generation. I just don't. So I think we better come. I think it's really a challenge for us to rely heavily on God for wisdom. Situations are different. Children are different. Very different sometimes within the same family. And sometimes about the time we think we have something figured out, God has a way of showing us that we just don't know too much after all in ourselves. I'd like you to turn to James chapter 3, verse 17. There's a verse here that I'm not sure how to say it. It's talking about wisdom, but I just like the picture it gives me of how to relate in wisdom to the rising generation. James 3:17 says, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And I can hardly read that verse without feeling like I have work to do to meet the standard. Pure, peaceable, easy to be entreated. Let's just read this in reverse now and see what kind of person emerges. But the wisdom from within myself is first tainted, then contentious, rude and unapproachable, full of hard-heartedness and poor choices, with partiality and with hypocrisy. You see, that's a little bit where we come from outside of God. And if we're not going to relate to others in that way, we're going to need the wisdom that's from above, which is pure, peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated. I'd like to think a little bit yet of love, thinking of a Bible-based life. You need the wisdom of God, and you also need the love of God in your heart. 1 John 4:7 would tell us that love is from God, or God is love. Everyone that loveth is born of God. And we understand that love is the foundation for any successful relationship and the godly essence within any interaction. Love is the foundation for any successful relationship and the godly essence within any interaction. And I believe that's true for whether it's Christian or non-Christian. Love is of God. And if you would go back to chapter 3 in 1 John, it talks about the children of God are manifested in the children of the devil. Whosoever doeth righteousness is whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth his brother. So it's very clear that the manifestation of God in human relationships is love. Likewise, the closest manifestation of the devil in human relationships is the lack of it. Again, whether it's Christian or non-Christian, love is of God. Let's move on to the R in the acrostic bridge. For the R, I have relationship. We've been talking about relationships. Relationships exist on the premise of goodness. And we're kind of inferring that by relationship, it's a positive thing. Now, I really think this is a pretty important point, because I don't think there's any way to bridge this gap without a relationship. I just don't see how. However, there can be good relationships and there can be bad. And so we're kind of inferring that a relationship is a positive thing. Not always. But what we're looking for is a working relationship. We want a relationship that's like that bridge that allows some crossing back and forth into each other's lives. I think this relationship is built by an evaluation of an anchor point on the opposite side. Just to illustrate a little bit, in our work, in our logging operations, we're not allowed to cross moving water without bridging it. And so we have these steel wood beam bridges that we take out, and using the grapple behind a skidder, we pick them up and we set them down, because technically we're not supposed to drive through the water. You're supposed to place the bridge without driving through the water. Somehow I think that's a little bit more illustrative of human relationships instead of road construction. So in road construction, you have the foundation built from both sides up. And maybe we could go with that. But so often in relationships, as parents, as teachers, I think it's up to us to evaluate the other side. What's going on over there? Where is a good place to cross? Where could I put a bridge that it's going to be sustainable? Where's a good anchor point? Where's something in that life that I can connect to? You know, taking Junior along to the tree stand may not generate any venison, but it does generate a bond. And the implications of reaching into his soul will go far deeper than your 3-foot chest freezer. And that's only an illustration. There's many more, and you'll have to figure it out with your children, with those you're teaching. What is it in their life that you can connect to build a relationship with them, to build that bridge? This relationship, I think, too, is built by not forcing your way into his life, but by letting him into yours. think there's a lot of value in sharing our own experiences that have shaped us. And be willing to share your own struggle. Cocooning ourselves in a shell of hierarchy is not true patriarchy and will hardly produce generational continuity. Cocooning ourselves in a shell of hierarchy is not true patriarchy and will hardly produce generational continuity. There was a man I worked with years ago. I was in my upper teens, early 20s. And he was in his 60s. And I just loved working with him. There's something about his positive spirit, his walk with God. He had this little testament he carried in his pocket, and I would see him reading it over lunchtime, and he just was really an inspiration to me. And there were some years where I was going through some struggles myself, and I remember at lunch breaks sometimes he would just ask how it's going, and he shared different times things that he had went through. And it was interesting to me that there was a period in his life where he was very low emotionally. And he pulled through it by the grace of God, and looking at him as an aged man, you would have never guessed it. Now, him sharing those experiences didn't really make me think less of him. It actually made me think more of him, because you could see the work of God in his life taking him from where he was to what he became. And so I think being willing to share our shaping experiences, share your own struggle, is a way to build the bridge. Now, these relationships you will not find in a bargain barn. And so for the I have an investment. Modern day bridges will cost anywhere from $50,000 to over $1 billion for major city structures. And in each of those situations, the person or community that's paying for that has determined that the access and convenience is worth more to them than the construction figure. And so they're willing to make that investment. And so let's just try to translate this scenario into human relationships a little bit. For number one, it's very costly. Too often, I think we want the benefit without the cost. We want the result without the journey. But we need to be upfront with ourselves and understand that this is going to cost me something. And am I willing to make the investment? Actually, this investment, the building of these bridges, I don't think has a completion date. It's actually probably going to take your whole life. Because when God told Moses, when they were coming out of Egypt, and God told Moses that I want you to tell all these things that have happened to your sons, he didn't just say your sons, he said your sons and your sons' sons. And so when our children are gone, I don't think God is indicating that, well, you're done now. Because there's likely sons' sons and daughters' daughters. And am I willing to make that investment? How much of my time and energy am I willing to spend on the next generation? And I know that the pressure can be very great. The concrete bill is due next week, and your son comes home with a math lesson, and that's due tomorrow. But you'll have to remember that grade scores are indicative of something far more important than a concrete structure. And long after that concrete is bought and paid for, your son will remember the emotional cost that bill will levied against him, if you allow it to do that. Am I willing to explain, thinking of working with the next generation? And sometimes I've seen it already, where fathers, maybe employers, have young sons or new employees, and you want them to learn, but the learning curve is too long and too costly, and so when I'm there, I just quick do it, and he kind of sidelined him. But I'm challenging myself. Am I willing to explain the process and willing to shoulder the cost of the learning curve, or is the demand for efficiency and production so high that the next generation barely has a chance to try their hand at the plow? And I think this is something we probably face more than ever before in the way our industrial world operates. And everything has to be running efficiently and high production. And to have a son come along, he doesn't know, and he does something a little bit wrong, and you have a machine down or whatever. Am I willing to shoulder that cost because the life and well-being of that son is worth more to me than what it might cost for him to work alongside of me and learn? This was made more clear to me recently when one of the fellows that works with me is an older father and has had some disappointments with at least one of his sons. And he told me just recently that he said if he could do anything over, he said, I would invest far more in my family than in my work. He said, I realize now that looking back over the years, I allowed the bills, the mortgage, to just drive me to work. And now, sadly, that father today feels like he lost a son. And his son's testimony is that it was because of the father. Just something to think about. The D in our acrostic tonight, I have devotion. I'd like you to turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. These are kind of familiar verses, but I'd just like to look at them here a little bit. Deuteronomy 6, I'm going to read verse 6 and 7. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. I think we're just going to stop there. I'd like you to first of all note in verse 6 where he says, these words are supposed to be where? In your heart. Now, sometimes we say, even if something isn't in our heart, if it's the right thing to do, we should do it. But I'm thinking here on this D of devotion, and I'm thinking about my personal walk with God, leading the family in worship. And I'm not so sure that this idea that, well, if it's not in my heart, I'll just do it anyway. I'm wondering if that's good advice for this thought of devotion, because I think if this is done in pretense, it's far worse. A form of godliness without the power is an aversion to any genuine soul or any genuine seeker. And to offend one of these little ones by hypocritical living, Jesus says, your life should be ended at the bottom of the sea. And so I would plead with each of us, let's have it in our heart. Verse 6, these words, these commandments, I want to be in your heart. And let's have it first of all there. He goes on to say, teach them diligently then to your children. When you sit in your house, and we have this thing we call family worship or devotions. And there's something I believe happens in those few minutes or hour, whatever time you put into it. There's something that happens there that you cannot accomplish in any other way. When you sit together as a family and you sing and you pray for each of your children by name, I know for me, to hear my name in prayer and praying for me as I went to work or to school, and praying for me that when I come to the year's accountability, I'd be willing to give it all to God. There's something that happens in your heart that I'm not sure how it could happen any other way. So by all means, pray together. Pray for your children by name. Sitting in your house, another thing could be mealtime conversations. I think it was Ben Franklin that remembers his father, he said, would always take great care to begin conversation at the table that would build, educate, and unify the family. And Ben said that he was so effective at this that so many of the times he scarcely knew what he was eating, or he found it very difficult to remember what he had eaten. And he for sure didn't really think about if the food was fine or ill prepared, he said, because his father had a conversation going to engage the family, to educate, to unify, that he scarcely thought of what he was eating. Well, this verse goes on to say, when you walk by the way. And there's so many things, so many opportunities we have to point something out about God, what he's doing, or what he did, or how you see God in this picture as you're walking by the way. Maybe you love the stars. So exploring the expanse of the solar system. Or maybe the diversity of the animal kingdom. And as you connect in that way with your children, it connects you on a far deeper level than any lengthy discourse on the pros and cons of a 30-odd six versus a 270 Winchester. There's something that happens that will not happen in secular conversation. For the G here in our acrostic, I have guidance, and I'd like to go back to 1 Samuel for this one. First Samuel chapter 2, this is Eli and the sad story of his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. I'm going to read here just a couple verses. Here, 1 Samuel 22, verse 22 to 26. Now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And he said unto them, why do ye do such things? For I hear of your evil doings by all this people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress. If one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? Notwithstanding, they hearken not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them. I'd like you to just jump over here to chapter 3. I'm going to read verse 11 to verse 14. This was God's words to Samuel. Remember that story. God came to Samuel by night, and he says in verse 11, behold, I will do a thing in Israel, at which both the ears of everyone that heareth it shall tingle. And that day I will perform against Eli all those things which I have spoken concerning his house. When I begin, I will also make an end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. And therefore I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be purged with sacrifice nor offering forever. Oh, poor Eli, what a stain on your name. God says your iniquity, your sin is not going to be purged with sacrifice or offering forever. What's even sadder to realize is that it seems like Eli knew it all along. What did he do about it? Nay, my sons, it's not a good thing. We could go into a lot of things here under this thought of guidance. But here with Eli, it seems like the awful conduct was allowed to fester until it consumed all Israel. That's what it says. It consumed all Israel, at least most of them. Poor Eli, what a gap you allowed and what a generation you lost. The next generation will need guidance, direction, discipline. How often do you think Hophni and Phinehas got some sound advice or clear direction from Pop Eli? Other than a few words, God really lays a lot of accountability on Eli. Now, his sons obviously had their just judgment as well. But Eli, having known, and not other than a little bit of a, hey, just back it off here, God says, you're going to bear some responsibility for this. How often do you think they got clear direction, some guidance, maybe even as young children, some discipline? Or do you think that Eli just supposed that his high priestly office would somehow beget godliness in the next generation? Sometimes I think we're a little bit, we just kind of think that, well, if we do the right thing and we're here and somehow that's going to beget some godliness. I'm afraid it won't. God actually says these sons of Eli, he says they're sons of Belial or sons of the devil, and they knew not the Lord. And so that would seem to indicate that even as young boys growing up, well, they knew not the Lord. I don't know what all you want to read into that. Ephesians 6:4, and ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. For E, our last point here, I have an eternal perspective. So I think for the first point and this last point, that's more of a, or it's more of an adjective, eternal perspective rather than guidance and investment relationship. I'd like to go to Hebrews chapter 11. I really believe if we're going to successfully bridge the generation gap, we're going to have something in common beyond this life. Here in Hebrews 11, let's read verse 8 to verse 10. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in a land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. I kind of like this picture of Abraham dwelling in tabernacles with his son and his son's son. And it doesn't say that they were heirs of the land of Canaan. It says they were heirs of the promise of a better country. And I would think that if these patriarchs, these men of old, would have wanted to live it up, they probably could have. They had received this inheritance. It was theirs. But they weren't living that way. They weren't looking like that. It was an eternal perspective within Abraham and within Isaac and within Jacob, looking for a better country. And I think in this day and age, if we're going to successfully bridge this generation gap, we're going to have an eternal perspective. We're going to have to communicate with the next generation the realities of eternity, the rewards of the faithful, and the just judgment of the ungodly. Well, Isaac, Jacob, they were those good old patriarchs. They weren't as little boys. They weren't heirs of this promise because they were somehow just supernaturally good. It was something they had to work on too. It was a perspective that they had to work to keep and to lay hold on by faith. And it's no different for us today. Well, here in conclusion, you've probably heard this before, but I'm just going to read it here in the conclusion of the message. An old man going a lone highway came at the evening cold and gray to a chasm vast and deep and wide through which was flowing a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fear for him. But he turned when safe on the other side and built a bridge to span the tide. Old man, said a fellow pilgrim near, you're wasting your strength with building here. Your journey will end with the ending day. You never again will pass this way. You've crossed the chasm deep and wide. Why build this bridge at evening tide? The builder lifted his old gray head. Good friend, in the path I have come, he said, there followeth after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm that has been naught to me, to that fair-haired youth, may a pitfall be. He too must cross in the twilight dim. Good friend, I'm building this bridge for him. And God bless you each as you endeavor to do that in your lives, in the places God has called you to. Let's kneel for prayer. Thank you.